Hello and welcome to Macro Bites, the economics and politics podcast from Aberdeen. My name is Paul Diggle and today we are focusing in on UK politics in the wake of the UK local election results. And we're going to talk about the economic challenges facing the UK government and what it all means for a potential future general election and for investors. So joining me in this discussion are Jeremy Lawson, our chief economist at Aberdeen, and Luke Bartholomew, our senior economist who covers the UK. So Luke, let's start with you. The veteran UK sophologist John Curtis has described these local election results as bad for the Conservatives, but not good enough for Labour. Can you briefly outline the shape of the result across the various key battlegrounds?
Sure, thanks, Paul. And far from to disagree with John Curtis there, I think that is a good and fair summary. So I guess the key points are that in England, Labour performed extremely well in London, the Conservatives losing a number of key trophy councils that they've held in previous, some of their worst election performances. So to lose them now is quite striking. Labour also performed relatively well in sort of so-called affluent university towns, whilst in the red wall, so those seats that the Conservatives took from Labour at the last general election, there was a small swing from Labour to the Conservatives, but they probably held up slightly better than they might have worried about, which I think all goes to show that Brexit politics continues to cast quite a long shadow, at least over English politics, with Leave voters and Leave areas still leaning Conservative, whilst the Remain coalition sort of splits between Labour and Liberal Democrats. In Scotland, I guess the striking thing was that Labour are now back to second party status, beating out the Conservatives there. I think that's large part to do with the unpopularity of Boris Johnson in Scotland and more broadly the leadership of the Scottish Labour Party. And then in Northern Ireland, there was a quite striking result in that Sinn Féin became the largest party in the Assembly, the first time that a Republican supporting party has been the largest party in the Assembly. And obviously, this poses quite difficult constitutional questions for the UK that we can get to later, but also around Brexit matters, as well as the DUP refused to put up ministers for a power-sharing government whilst the Northern Ireland Protocol remains as it is.
Great. I think that's a really useful summary. So, Jeremy, we've seen a few different seat projections that read across from these locals to a general election, as if a general election were being held tomorrow. And they tend to show either Labour or the Conservatives as the largest party, but crucially, neither achieving a majority. So with the caveat that we always have to be careful reading across from locals to general elections, what do you think the implications are for a future general election in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly when we keep in mind that the next general election could be as late as December 2024, that's 2.5 years of water to go under the bridge between now and then, and likely a very significant sort of slowing of economic growth, you know, over that period to contend with. But a couple of the things that I think we can see sort of straight away is that even a trend that has been in place for some time, which is that the Conservative Party are becoming increasingly the party of England, and what we might call, and I think Luke alluded to this, regional and smaller town England. So that is sort of being strengthened. And so that's not a particularly firm foundation for a broad coalition, particularly as it sort of struggles to reconcile policies that can appeal to both the new supporters that's gained since Brexit in the so-called red wall seats, but then the type of priorities that its traditional supporters sort of favour, particularly in the southeast and the southwest of England. So I think that's one tension. Another tension, though, on the Labour side is that, you know, equivalently, you cannot win a general election if you are, in a sense, being shut out of the devolved, in the devolved sort of countries, by virtue of the fact that regional parties dominate, and you can't make true headway in the smaller towns, i.e. London and university towns does not make a general election victory. And so that, I think, is why a minority government is not a reasonable, is not an unreasonable sort of starting point for thinking about what next election outcome might be. And then, of course, though, then there's going to be sort of lots of sort of potential sort of swings and roundabouts related to the macroeconomic environment, the international political environment, potential sort of scandals we're sort of currently experiencing, sort of, you know, both Partygate and Beergate at the same time. So sort of trying to predict what comes next is immensely difficult. But I think what we do know is that both parties are going to struggle to form a governing sort of coalition, and unless there's something sort of that breaks in a particular way within the economic and political environment.
Great. And one of the tensions, I think, in these results is that the UK's constitutional questions, the status of the devolved nations, has become all the more heightened because now you have both in Scotland and in Northern Ireland a largest party that is explicitly against the union. To what extent is that a big problem or issue in UK politics at the moment?
I think it's an issue in UK politics because it does make it difficult for the leadership in the devolved regions and centrally to work together toward to solve what are in many cases sort of common problems, not just idiosyncratic problems. I mean, Northern Ireland was already challenging because of the tensions around the protocol. Sinn Féin are committed to try and work towards reunification with the Republic, but there is not a majority sort of support for that within Northern Ireland. And, you know, the DUP at this stage don't look like they want to join a sort of governing coalition to progress. And so we're sort of looking at sort of more time of effectively without executive government in Northern Ireland. I don't think that can ever really be a sort of a positive thing for regular people living in these sort of areas. And, you know, there are sort of massive sort of collective problems that need to be addressed. For all the talk of leveling up is a slogan, it's not a policy program at the moment. For all the talk of the need for structural reform to offset the negative effects of Brexit, we've seen almost no structural reform in the United Kingdom. Again, this is not just a Westminster problem. I would sort of say that it was equally true when we look at devolved governments. When you have this type of setup, it's very easy to blame parties on the other side. So if you're Scottish, you can make hay out of blaming problems on the English government or the Westminster government, but also sort of vice versa. And so there's this type of sort of stasis that sets in that is then amplified by the nature of the economic problems the UK faces, and is not isolated in this, but, you know, the world, the UK is experiencing this really sort of significant, what we'll call a negative supply shock, something that's meaning that it's pushing inflation up, it's pushing growth down, or it's going to push growth down. This is an invidious problem for policy making. There are no easy trade-offs here, but government is sort of stuck, and none of the parties, I think, have a really convincing sort of platform for turning that around, in part because it brings about tough choices and trade-offs that those constituents don't really want to hear. So I think this is the essence of the problem.
But just to add one other quick thought to that, because I think it's pretty easy to sketch out what the constitutional issues are for Scotland and Northern Ireland, both polities being governed by a party that isn't committed to the union. But there are also potential questions about England's place in this after the next election, because you can quite plausibly sketch out a scenario where the Conservatives end up the largest party in England, but insufficiently sized to form a majority in the UK Parliament, and Labour's able to form a government, a minority government with support from the SNP. And given the way devolution works in the UK, the UK government will be legislating for matters that affect England, but not Scotland. So you have SNP votes propping up legislation in England with a Labour government, which is the smaller party in England. All of that might raise questions about how English voters feel within the union as well. So there are pressures in multiple directions, I think.
Just to amplify that point, Paul, if you don't mind, it may not, for people living in the UK in particular, but also outside, the Britain's sort of constitutional arrangements really are highly unusual. So devolved powers are different depending on which sort of devolved sort of like, you know, authority that you're talking about. Instead of having a true federal authority, effectively the two are mixed between, you know, England and the national authority. So in a sense, England's sort of constitutional sort of status is very unusual, most unlike what you would see in other federations. You know, you don't have very prescribed what are federal powers, what are state powers. These things are much more contested. You know, the constitution is sort of governed by convention as much as it is by statute. And so it sort of all sort of sums up to something that probably says, hey, the work of devolution that really got under the way under the Blair years, but was never really finished, the UK needs a constitutional convention. But politically, it's incredibly difficult to get to a point where you could imagine such a convention yielding outcomes that could themselves receive consent across a broad range of these authorities so that progress could be made towards a better arrangement.
Yes, the West Lothian question remains unanswered, and indeed has more questions have been raised in the meantime. But let's get into the economics of all this then. So as you were saying there, Jeremy, the economic context in the UK at the moment is slowing growth, high inflation, a possible recession is on people's radars now as well, rising interest rates, and these economic challenges are of course difficult to deal with. Jeremy, let's start about thinking about the cost of living crisis and possible government responses to it. So one that is sometimes mooted is a fiscal support package for households. Can you explain why economically that's actually not the slam dunk obvious policy that perhaps politically it would seem to be at this juncture?
Yeah, I think it's relatively simple. So for listeners, sort of think about one of the problems that the UK has at the moment, or one of the drivers of the cost of living crisis, is effectively excess demand in the economy, right? So in a sense, too much money chasing too few goods in the, you know, in a phrase, the sort of has been used in the past. And so if you provide significant fiscal stimulus, so demand side support, right, this is going to flow through into the disposable incomes of households, right? And it may seem like the right thing to do because so many people are struggling with that cost of living shock, with the increase in inflation and wages not keeping up with the increase in prices. But some of this is going to find its way into spending. In fact, that is the point in many cases. But if there's more spending and the underlying supply problems aren't dealt with, then ultimately you're going to make the inflation problem worse. So actually, in some ways, this is the essence of a wage inflation spiral if you were to do it too aggressively. Now, of course, the Bank of England would not sort of sit by neutrally under those circumstances if that stimulus was large enough and was forced to revise up its sort of estimates for economic growth and inflation, then ultimately it's likely to deliver an even tighter monetary policy, larger increases in interest rates than it would do in the absence of that stimulus. So now that might sort of seem we're sort of caught on the horn of a dilemma. Is there any way out of it? Look, I think that there's no perfect way out of it, but what we do know is that the distributional effects of this cost of living shock are very uneven. There are some groups, particularly those that maybe didn't benefit from the income and asset price surge in the first place, sort of immediately after the pandemic, that are struggling the most because a larger share of their, you know, their day-to-day expenditure is on the items that have increased the most in cost. So I personally think that there is an opportunity to have a very targeted support package that sort of effectively sort of ensures that no household need fall into poverty as a result, or, you know, of this cost of living shock. And so we deal with that particular issue, but the cost of that and the size of that package would be relatively modest and potentially offset by other sort of measures such that it wasn't adding net stimulus to the overall economy and therefore making the inflation problem worse.
Yeah, think redistribution rather than outright stimulus. But what about some of the mooted measures that I think are starting to be floated, things like a general VAT cut or perhaps a rebate of the upcoming energy price cap increase? Because at least mechanically for measured inflation, general VAT cut would be deflationary, at least in the statistics. Are those measures we should be looking out for?
I don't know what you think, Luke. I mean, you know, they are options. They might superficially make the short-term inflation problem look less severe. But again, in the sort of sense of the way, I mean, the central bank will tend to look through tax changes anyway when it's trying to assess the true underlying inflation problems or trends in the economy, right? So if it's sort of looking through that, but focusing again more on this question of, is demand too high relative to supply? Does that require a tighter policy setting? Then the point becomes again, are you adding net stimulus significantly, sort of such that the Bank of England would be revising up its underlying inflation forecasts on the multi-year horizon? And if it was doing that, then ultimately it's not going to help make the problem better. It might make the problem worse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the government has tried to frame its defeat in terms of, or its poor results in the local election in terms of, a cost of living crisis, and we hear your pain and we will do something about it. So I'm pretty sure the political logic of the situation is some sort of policy response is coming, and that is likely to take the sort of headline catching form that you've been discussing there, Paul, VAT cuts, not least because the redistribution, not fiscal stimulus route, which is perhaps economically optimal, is probably quite difficult for the Conservative government to push through given its own sort of electoral coalition. It's precisely its voters that would be redistributed from, I suspect, in that case. But all of that means that it's just adding demand to an economy that is already suffering from excess demand, and therefore that puts demands on the Bank of England to have tighter monetary policy than it otherwise would have done.
So if adding demand, aggregate demand into the economy is difficult at this juncture because of the inflation environment, we as economists would naturally turn to supply expanding policies, and that would have the benefit of helping tackle the UK's lackluster potential growth rate, a long-running economic challenge in the United Kingdom. Luke, we're not actually seeing a particularly convincing supply-side reform agenda at the moment. Can you explain why that is and what a supply expanding agenda would look like?
Sure. And I mean, it is worth saying that the reason to have a supply expanding agenda is less about the short-term inflation dynamic than it is much more about these long-term issues of productivity and potential growth. That is ultimately what pins down people's living standards in the medium to long run. And if you look at real incomes in the 15 or so years since the financial crisis, I mean, they've been absolutely dire in the UK. It's not just a cost of living crisis of this year. Real wages are still below where they were before we went into the crisis. And that's not an inflation story so much as a productivity story. So why has so little been done about that? Well, I think partly it reflects both the electoral and ideological commitments of the government in some way. The one, you know, measure that's often talked about for the UK is significant deregulation of the planning system to allow for a huge increase of house building in the southeast of England, in particular on the so-called Greenbelt. And on this, I think the government itself is pretty ideologically committed to doing so. They have put forward in the past relatively significant reforms to the planning system, but have ultimately had to water those down significantly because of issues around their electoral coalition, that these measures are extremely unpopular in the so-called blue wall seats of southeast England. And so those kind of measures don't take place because of electoral considerations. And then on the ideological side, I mean, I can't help but say that the lowest of low-hanging fruit to boost the UK supply side would simply be to rejoining the single market at the very least. I mean, we estimate that leaving the single market takes around 5% or so off the level of UK GDP over 10 years. Let me tell you, there aren't many policies that add 5% to the level of your GDP. Like, those aren't just lying around on the pavement, easily picked up. So the kind of things that you're going to need to do to make up from that shortfall that comes from leaving a single market are quite significant. And of course, it's the ideological commitments of the government, which mean they can't do that. And similarly around, you know, freer movement of workers as well, that would be supply boosting, potentially productivity boosting as well. And then the other issue is around this question of levelling up, which Jeremy described as a slogan rather than a policy agenda. And I suspect that is largely true. But it is also worth saying that it's not entirely clear that in the short term, even if there were a substantive policy agenda behind it, it would be the kind of thing that would boost productivity in the short term. It may require in the short term policies that actually sort of harm potential growth, because, you know, you are diverting capital, trying to divert people away from coming to highly productive areas, London for the sake of example, and instead keeping them in the other provincial towns of the UK, which over the medium to long run might boost potential growth insofar as you create new agglomerations, and perhaps that's a more equal, stable economic geography. But in the short term, as I say, those kind of policies might end up hurting potential growth as well. So both the political and ideological commitments of this government make it quite difficult for it to pursue the kind of substantial supply-side reforms that we need.
Jeremy, have you got a supply-side agenda that you would be recommending to the UK government at the moment?
Yeah, Luke and I actually wrote a paper before the pandemic, which was somewhat overtaken by events. I think we may have published it just 2 months before the pandemic, and a lot of those priorities sort of dissipated somewhat. But I do think that there are a few. Again, a lot of this relates not to what I describe as the level of public spending, but the distribution of that spending. So we know that over a long period of time, public investment in the United Kingdom has been run down relative to rates that would be sort of consistent with the type of infrastructure that's going to be required, not just for narrow economic purposes, but also to meet climate goals. You know, HS2 in some ways has been a red herring within this debate, but there are myriads of smaller interlinking projects, you know, in rail and in ports, in road transportation, whole host of areas which over the long term could add to, you know, potential output. And, you know, they may not have the, you know, the sexiness of a big sort of, you know, big high profile project, but added up, they can be really powerful. But again, this is a program that you can't see as a 1-year, 2-year, 3-year sort of thing, particularly in an economy facing short-term supply constraints. Instead, you need a multi-decadal program to restore that infrastructure and probably some bipartisan commitments. That's one. You know, something that I think is important, I mean, you know, the UK, like many economies, has got female participation rates that are considerably sort of below those of male men. This can be thought of as a loss of potential output. And we've done sort of quite compelling empirical work of our own that suggests that the leave policies and tax policies in the United Kingdom sort of significantly contribute to the disincentives for, you know, for some women to work. So it's not to say that we should be dictating individual choices that people make, but what you can do is remove barriers that force them down particular pathways. You know, real spending on education has been mired in a slump for 12 years now, and is a great example of where you're cutting off your nose to spite your face, because, you know, without an investment in education, again, particularly particularly in, you know, we're talking about leveling up, you know, a greater commitment to educational spending and equality in regional areas, you know, could be sort of potentially part of the solution here, but it sort of just hasn't been realized. So across infrastructure, across sort of social policy, the nature of the tax and transfer system, you know, education, health, there's a whole host of areas where I think are ripe for change, even if we're not going to be sort of reversing Brexit. And I think we can sort of give up on that idea on any sort of intermediate time frame. But there is a lot that can be done to at least mitigate those effects. And the question is, you know, is there a party that is prepared to sort of take those sort of hard decisions that are required and difficult choices that are required to make that happen?
Great. So I want to end the podcast by bringing all that together and being very clear on why it all matters directly for the economy and then for financial markets and investors. And I think there are a number of ways. First, because although the near-term personal risks around the Prime Minister may have not been as acute as could have been the case, there are clearly a number of upcoming flashpoints that may challenge Boris Johnson's leadership of the Conservative Party, and clearly a Conservative leadership race would inject some near-term political uncertainty into the outlook. Second, I think because the future of the Northern Ireland Protocol is still to be settled, and the potential collapse of power sharing, disagreements between the DUP and Sinn Féin add to some of the risks there, and it's likely that a further UK-EU dispute over the protocol is inevitable. Third, I think because more broadly on Ireland, the largest party is now one committed to a border poll. That's also the case in Scotland. So as we've discussed, the UK's constitutional structure remains in flux. Fourth, because we were expecting at least some action on UK fiscal policy, but as we've talked about, measures to alleviate the cost of living crunch could just as equally end up exacerbating inflation pressures. And then fifth, because UK potential growth, as we've said, remains pretty lackluster, and some of the political commitments to a supply side agenda that would help tackle that are lacking. So that's about all we have time for this week. Thank you, Jeremy and Luke, for joining us and sharing your insights. And thank you to you for listening to Macro Bites. Please do like and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. But until next time, goodbye and good luck out there.
This podcast is provided for general information only and assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets. It is provided for informational purposes only and should not be considered as an offer, investment recommendation, or solicitation to deal in any of the investments or products mentioned herein, and does not constitute investment research. The views in this podcast are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily reflect those of Aberdeen. The companies discussed in this podcast have been selected for illustrative purposes only, or to demonstrate our investment management style and not as an investment recommendation or indication of their future performance. The value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, and investors may get back less than the amount invested. Past performance is not a guide to future returns, return projections, or estimates, and provide no guarantee of future results.